Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
Michael Hohmeyer back with us, and it is the It's the Law segment of Dresser After Dark. Michael, hey, well, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you as always, Michael Ray.
I've got four letters to say to you. Two letters, a dash, and a number. EB-5.
EB-5, yep, red hot. This is the immigrant investor financing of U.S. businesses while creating U.S. jobs. It's a great program.
Now the program in and of itself, what was it about that program, Michael, that got you interested in the first place? What triggered you to look at this thing and say, hey, this is workable?
Great question. You and I have spent some time talking about the impact of politics on the economy. And as you know, as a business lawyer, we represent in my firm nothing but business owners. And so one of our jobs is trying to help new and existing businesses find money. That money may be equity, it may be coming from investment, or it could be debt financing if folks are trying to borrow from a bank. You know, when the recession happened, basically U.S. sources of money dried up. The banks stopped lending, and investors decided to sit on the sidelines and wait until economic policies return to some kind of sanity. They haven't yet, so money remains unavailable to U.S. businesses. EB-5 is a program that was established by the Congress 20 years ago to compete with other nations' immigration programs that were saying, look, if successful entrepreneurial folks are willing to bring themselves, their brains, and their finances and relocate to our country and invest in businesses in our country that create jobs in our country, we will give them a different process for obtaining residency. And the U.S. decided, after watching other countries be very successful with this, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, even the U.K., the U.S. decided we've got to get in on this game. It's been more or less a kind of quiet industry until the recession hit 3 years ago, when money dried up here. U.S. businesses got desperate and said, we've got to start looking around to raise money from any source. And this program, folks said, hey, this is underutilized. Let's see if we get involved with this. And the result has been a program that looks like by the end of the year will end up resulting in bringing in $3 billion of outside money into the American economy and creating tens of thousands of U.S. jobs in the process.
Michael, let me hold you up. Let's break it down. When we talk about investment money, does the money come outside the border or inside the border? Where does the first money come from?
The money comes from outside the border. The money belongs to foreigners who are typically business owners themselves in their home countries, and they have earned sufficient money and have the desire to relocate to the United States that they're willing to make an investment into U.S. businesses and thereby create U.S. jobs, in return for which they're allowed to get conditional residency and ultimately permanent residency in the United States. So it's all foreign money. It's almost like, since China is the biggest source of EB-5 investors, it's almost like all of the money we hear that has left the United States and gone to China, some of that money is coming back.
Okay, so some of that, well, the money or the profit, one way or the other. But let's say, for instance, okay, I'm Chinese, I'm a Chinese citizen, I want to come here. So I've got $500,000, I've got $500,000 to spend here. Who do I give the money to, and then where does it go from there?
the money gets given to, or rather invested in, U.S. businesses. These are all American businesses. They can be startup businesses. They can be failing businesses that are trying desperately to be saved so that they will not go down the tubes and those jobs be lost, or they're new businesses with new job creation. They may be by people starting a new business for the first time who are sophisticated enough to get involved in this program, or they may be established businesses like hotel developers, other real estate people. Real estate is the primary American industry in which EB-5 financing is being applied, but it's not the only industry. So the foreigners invest in a U.S. business. Typically, we as American lawyers, we represent the U.S. businesses that are looking to receive the immigrant investor funds. And obviously, the program requires that there be jobs created in order for the immigrant to receive a permanent residency in the United States.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, I've got $500,000 I want to invest in a business. It's a widget-making business. So I invest $500,000 into the widget-making business. Now, I'm going to have to guarantee that there's going to be minimally 10 jobs that have been created for the $500,000 I'm investing into the business.
That's exactly right. What happens is the U.S. business that we represent, our job is to put together the documents that are required by U.S. law, both immigration law and U.S. securities laws that govern investments in U.S. businesses. They apply to foreigners just the way they apply to Americans. We make sure that the client's documents are shipshape. They go overseas. They work through networks of agents in the foreign countries who introduce the investment opportunities to their fellow citizens. If enough investors are interested in investing, then they will do so, and in return, they are then, once they've invested in a U.S. business, they are then allowed to apply for a conditional green card. Within 2 years after they receive their conditional green card, the American business in which they invested must have used their investment and that of all of the fellow investors in the project to create, as you say, 10 jobs per investor. And if sufficient American jobs are created, then each investor will get his conditional green card made permanent after the end of that two-year period.
Okay, now let's pencil this out and let's extrapolate here. So let's say we want to get a million jobs. We want to create a million jobs. So that's going to take 100,000 investors to 100,000 times 10 is a million. That's going to be 100,000 investors to get our million jobs. Now, that is $500,000 apiece times 100,000 investors, which gives us, pencil that out, that's a lot of money dumped into the economy. Because the other thing that we have to look at, let's add this to the mix. If in the Milwaukee area, if I spend $100 here in three or four stores, that $100 is going to circulate at least 6 to 7 times. So that $100 that I spend is really worth $600, $800, $1,000. So everybody spends $500, $600 in the stores, you can take that time 6 and 8 times. So if we get that kind of money, those $1 billion flowing through the businesses that create the kind of economy that we will be allowed to make money and spend money because there's jobs, there's going to be a lot of money flowing. I think it's a brilliant program.
Exactly right. We're talking about the potential for huge amounts of money to return to the United States, to be put to work in starting and growing and in some cases saving U.S. businesses, hiring new people or saving the jobs of folks who might otherwise be thrown out of work if their business failed because they don't have access to money domestically. Yes, we're talking about additional people coming into the United States to live, but the number of jobs that are created for Americans already here far exceeds the number of immigrants who are allowed to come in through this program. At the moment, there are 10,000 visas set aside for the EB-5 program. So We're not talking about millions of immigrants being able to utilize this program the way that it's structured. On the other hand, we are talking about tens and potentially hundreds of thousands, maybe even, as you say, millions of jobs, American jobs being created at a time when nobody anywhere else is having much luck creating real jobs in the private sector.
See, my feeling about it is this, as I listen to it. I am absolutely against illegal, that's the operative word, Michael, illegal immigrants coming into the country and doing whatever they do. But now we are talking about people that have the wherewithal. They have the financial background to invest in the businesses here and really become what an American is really all about, because they would be participating in the system. So you bring another 100,000 in, that's okay, because they come in legally, they come in participating in the system, and they'll come in basically as Americans.
Well, actually, you're entirely right about that. The numbers are even more dramatic when you think we're talking about 10,000 people coming in, foreigners, coming into the United States. People have attacked this program saying they're buying green cards, and I guess you could characterize it that way, but you always have to keep in mind the flip side to that coin is while they're buying a green card, the money that they're investing in the U.S., that they're putting at risk, they can lose it all, just like any investor can lose their investment. There's no guarantees here. In fact, the law prohibits guarantees, so their money has to be at risk. These foreigners are willing to risk their money, yes, in order to get into the country, but remember, they do not get their permanent green card unless their investment is proved to the government satisfaction to have created U.S. jobs where there were none before. So whether it's buying a green card or not, the price is not just the money, it's also that they're creating U.S. jobs.
Okay, let's tackle that problem when someone says they're buying a green card. If you buy a green card and the money's under the table and you do everything you can illegally to get that card, absolutely we should be against that. But if you're buying a green card when it's all on top of the table and the source is open and it's constructive, what's wrong with that? Nothing.
I agree. And instead, it's providing a real opportunity not only for foreigners who have a dream, as so many of our own ancestors have, of coming to this country and making a better life for themselves and especially their children, which remains the primary motivation of these immigrant investors to invest in the United States. It is because they want, and they want their children to become Americans.
They want to participate.
Go ahead.
Michael, I'm not that, they want to participate, yes.
Yes, they do. And yet, at the same time, they're doing something that the U.S. government and that U.S. private industry, frankly, can't at the moment do. I think private industry because the government's policies are preventing it from creating jobs. But the government's not creating jobs. It's taking taxpayer dollars and paying public employees are not true job creation. And we know in the private sector, job creation is virtually nil at this moment, even though our population continues to expand. The only people I know of on a significant scale who are creating U.S. jobs, believe it or not, are these immigrant investors and their investments through the EB-5 program.
And I think one great rule would be don't do anything with alternative energy resources.
Well, yes. You know, the EB-5 program allows investor monies to be used in any industry. Indeed, there are EB-5 projects around the country, in most states in the country, and those projects are in all industries. And they range from real estate development, hotels, office buildings, senior citizen facilities, critical care, hospitals, to industries other than real estate, like agriculture, manufacturing, retail, commercial retail, all the way to, believe it or not, film and television production. In each of these industries, those investments are creating jobs within those industries. And in return for that, we have, as you mentioned, entrepreneurs, people who are used to creating jobs, creating employment, creating wealth, creating businesses, creating opportunities, bringing their talents to the United States. And remember, once they go through the EB-5 program, which they only do once because you only need one green card, once you've got it, you're done. Once they're here, we should all expect that these entrepreneurial-minded people, after they become Americans, will continue to do what they've done before they came to our shores, and that's continue to establish and grow businesses and put Americans, more Americans, to work. I think that's the American dream for everybody.
Oh, I think that's absolutely wonderful. We're just about out of time. By the way, I have to talk to you. There's some real interesting stuff going on, but I'm not going to say it on the air because Radio Susie might hear us. Okay. Anyhow, so if you're around tomorrow, give me a call or I'll call you. And a website we can find you at.
The website we're at is www.homeierlaw.com. That's HOMEIERLAW.com. And happy to tell anybody who contacts us more information about this tremendous EB-5 opportunity.
And by the way, you part of what you do is protecting intellectual property, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is.
Well, I know somebody who's going to write a chapter in somebody's book about how to protect yourself with intellectual property when you're an author or you're a writer or you're somebody.
I could suggest some authors who could help you out on that very task.
Oh, no, I don't want an author. I know who I'm going after. we'll talk to you tomorrow. Good night.
Look forward to that, Michael Ray.
The only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gigi Stetler with us. She is the author of Unstoppable: Surviving is Just the Beginning. She's a serial survivor turned author and motivational speaker. From being stabbed 21 times and left for dead, betrayal from a father figure mentor, and a $4 million bankruptcy courtesy of an industry that conspired against her, to realizing a multi-million dollar success as an entrepreneur despite being a high school dropout. Let's say, Gigi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. That must have hurt.
Which part? The mental stabbing or the physical?
Oh, no, the mental stabbing. The physical stabbing we get through. I think, I would say years ago, as most guys would know, but women know also, right in the middle of being in a fight, you don't feel what happens. And I imagine getting stabbed with the fear and everything. Did you actually feel it when it was going on?
I didn't feel the first one. When he stabbed me the first stab, when I had no idea that I was even stabbed, I fell onto the floor, the corner of the floor, and then I saw the blood all over the place, and then I still didn't know what happened. I thought he had just punched me, and then your adrenaline goes, and then he climbed on top of me, and then he started sawing me, and then I saw the knife. So then reality stepped in. But before that, no, I didn't know.
You know, I think one of the things that would probably happen with you, and only you could say this because you're the one who went through it, you probably turn around and say, thank you. Not that that was easy to go through, but to realize that there's nothing you can't face that you can't move through and come out ahead on.
You know, I've said this, I probably, I don't know when the first time I said this, but I've said it for as long as I can remember. If it doesn't kill you, it only makes you stronger. And you know, it's so cliche, and it's, you know, it kind of sounds stupid, you know, sometimes when, you know, little incidences happen, you know, but that was such a reality for me, and it's true. I mean, it didn't kill me. What did it make me stronger? I'm not sure, because I thought I was pretty strong before that, and that's why I was still alive, you know? So, but yes, it is a cliche, but it is so, so true.
Yeah, and because when you really come down to it in business, when you face things that would be a little scary to most people, and you look back and you see what you went through, and you didn't fall down forever, you did get back up, and that you can make it through. And I think that's a message for most people. People should not have to go through being stabbed and being let down and bankruptcies and whatever. That's a given. We shouldn't have to do that. But it happens, and we do that. But the key is you can learn from somebody who's been there, and you don't have to go through it yourself, because with some of the experiences you've had, you can bring it on to certain people, and then they can relate and anticipate what not to get in or what not to do and what to look out for.
Well, that's true, but, you know, there are no promises, and there's no one can lead anyone down the golden path, because it doesn't exist. And just, you know, for the record, I didn't file bankruptcy. What I call bankruptcy is, you know, a workout situation. Maybe emotional bankruptcy when, you know, when you're sitting on top of the world, and then the next thing you know that, you know, the world just fell out from under you. And, yeah. you fell 30 stories, you know, in one day. But, you know, I don't measure success by, you know, how much money I have in the bank yesterday. I measure success on how quickly people and myself got back up and dusted myself up and ran again and started over. That's what success is. And people are so afraid to fail that they don't even think about succeeding because they don't want to fail.
Well, I think that's really the key there, because so many people are so frightened of failing, they don't start, or they just stay stuck in that same.
They don't even try. They don't start. They don't try. Right.
Yeah, somebody might bite me, so I'm not going out today. No, and I got it loud and clear. But we live in such a confusing time today. Gigi, we're in a place where you don't know what's going to happen to the economy in the next 6 months, a year, 2 years. You don't know culturally what's going to happen to us. And the world right now is so topsy-turvy that most people think that the best thing to do is put their head in the sand and hide for a while, and maybe it'll all go away. But it doesn't go away.
No, and that is the biggest mistake that most people make is, I mean, really, today is a land of opportunity. Today is actually, you need to see the world today as an opportunity. And, I mean, it's just huge out there for investors. You know, there are bargains galore. So all those people that have stockpiled some money, start to spend it, you know, spend it and cash in and make deals. I mean, things are happening. And, you know, it's the land of opportunity today. And people are so chicken. What are you afraid of? You know, people need to get some balls and go out there, throw the dice. If you sit on the, you know, everyone puts their money in a mattress and sits there and looks at each other, then, you know, that is not going to make the world go round.
Okay, well, what was that thing with inside that caused you to move forward, that caused you not to stop?
First of all, my whole life and my whole persona is all about attitude. So the first thing that everyone needs to have is, you know, is the attitude, the positive attitude. And if that didn't work, so what? Try this. You know, if that door's closed, go out that door. If that door's closed, go out a window. I probably thought this even before I got stabbed, but to me, everything, anything is better than the alternative. And the only alternative is death.
No question. Well, there's so many people who aren't even alive. They're, you know, they're walking around, they're upright, and they're dead, and they have no idea what life in and of itself is about. Okay, I pick up Unstoppable.
Look at Steve Jobs. I mean, he's dead. You know, I mean, look at him. He worked all so hard in all these years. And what, you know what? Unfortunately, and most people in life, unlike him, I mean, that's bad luck. You know, what he had and what he created and what he had. But, you know, most people, they don't have anything that money can't fix. That man had something that money couldn't fix, and that's a terrible thing. And if you don't have money, if you don't have something that money can't fix, shame on you for crying.
Yeah. No, got it loud and clear. And because money can always be gotten, I don't care who you are. But if the other side of that, if you've got a debilitating disease that is progressing and there's nothing that anybody can do, well, you've tried. I mean, there's nothing there. But the other side of it, you're absolutely right. If you complain and you scream and you yell about what you don't have, go out and get it.
Exactly. Oh, you get exhausted. You know, some of the coaching that I do, I had a lady came in and she had bought these two companies on the internet, and one was a medical billing company, and she spent like $20,000 her life savings on it. She doesn't know anything about medical billing, and you know, she came to me to help her with the business plan and stuff, and I thought it was like a great idea, really great idea. But she says, well, I got to go talk to doctors, and I don't know how to sell anything. I don't know how to talk to doctors. I can't talk to them one on one. And I said, so you bought this company, a sales company, and you can't sell. You know, she bought the software, but she can't sell. I said, and she's like, yeah, pretty much. So I said, well, that's not a big deal. So put it out on Craigslist. You'll get 50 sales and put them on commission. You split it with them 50-50 because you have the money to buy the software and the salesmen don't have the money to buy the software. So it's a home run. So, you could sit home and collect 50% of everything that they write. And she's like, oh, that's a great idea. That's a great idea, you know. And she comes back for her second session and she says, That sounded like such a good idea, but I took a job at Walmart.
Yeah. As a cashier. Yeah, by the way, the next time you see her, tell her you met this guy with the bridge.
I know. I wish I would find clients like that would buy, a motorhome from me and just park it in the side of the road because they don't know how to put the gas in it or something stupid. I mean, I spent 2 hours with her coaching, putting this business plan together and everything, and then for her to come back and tell me she went to work at Walmart, I was so upset. I called her lazy. I said, you're lazy. You are just flat out lazy. That is wrong. That's what's wrong with half of our universe is they're lazy. So she just put the icing on the cake as far as the lazy people go. Totally lazy. And most of Americans are lazy. And I was listening to your program just before, and you were talking about the immigrants and stuff, and unfortunately, yeah. Sorry to say that they're the only ones at work.
Well, there's no question about it. See, I think what's happened is we have gotten so frightened. I'm going to use that word again. We've gotten so frightened that we lay down and we hide, and there's apathy. It's happening politically. It's happening in the culture, and it's happening in so many areas. It's not, we can go back to the 50s, and it wasn't that way then. And it seems as though the end of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, it started to slowly get into what's going on now. And I don't know if you've seen anybody interviewed with the kids that are over on Wall Street and they're demonstrating. They kept asking them the same questions. Why are you here? And the answers kept coming back. I don't know, but I'm here.
That's exactly the problem. They don't really know what they're voting for. They don't really know what they're arriving for. They don't know what they're fighting for. It's like even the guys that go to war, do they really know what they're fighting for? No.
No.
Someone told them and handed them a gun and told them to go over there and shoot people. They don't know what they're fighting for. And you know what? I guarantee you 99% of the Americans don't know what the hell they're fighting for. Nobody knows what they're fighting for.
But what it comes down to, it's not the kids that are over there doing it. They have their thoughts of the why, the wherefore, etc. But it always leads to the people who run the different countries have their own agendas. I mean, just any country that you look at, the Irans and so on and so forth. It's those people that are running the country that are living in a life of luxury. Everybody else is suffering. And they say,
I don't listen to that. It's brainwashing. It's called total brainwashing. Who would listen to a guy that's sitting there with a gold toilet and I'm sitting eating in the dirt?
I think that just happened here.
Yeah, right. is that the most? I can't comprehend that. I could not listen to a man that's sitting on a gold toilet and telling me to eat dirt. It's so annoying. But you know what? Going back to even our own country here, if you Like, he did a survey on, you know, 90% of the people that are on unemployment or some kind of disability benefits or something. I've had an ad running. I put ads on Craigslist, you know, for technicians, mechanics, you know, people that want to, I need people to come and work. And I can't get anyone to show up for a job. You know what? They come in and they say, well, could you just sign my card, your card that I was here looking for a job, but I don't really want one because my back hurts and I'm on disability, so, but I have to go out on 3 interviews a week. Could you just sign that I was here? That's what I get.
No, I got it.
And I ran very expensive ads looking for help, and that's what I get. But I have all the illegal immigrants that want to come here and beg me for work and will do anything, you know, scrub the floors, do whatever I need them to do for half the money. And it's not even about the way I would pay them full price, you know, because they work. It's not about the money. It's just that they want to work, and our people don't want to work. And that's really the bottom line. So when you, you know, I think that the whole jobless thing and the whole unemployment rate and the whole, you know, jobs are down and everything, it's just a political thing. It's all about the politics. You know, oh, I'm going to raise up. It's all about politics. You know, why don't you go ask those people that are standing there on the line looking for jobs? Why don't you go hire them and see if they show up?
You know, Geez, you got a really good point. I wish I could debate you, but I can't. The reality, I've seen a few things, you know, come across the internet, and I've watched and I've listened. You know, it's almost as if it you make out better if you're not working today. And you can use food stamps, you know, and all of the different McDonald's, the where, the this, the that, the whatever.
And they do some side jobs. They do side jobs under the table. That's what they do. Yeah. They do, you know, one side job a week, and unemployment, they're making three times as much. So
why am I sitting here behind a microphone? I think I'm going to go on unemployment. Too old. Okay, but when we really come down to it, no, you've hit it. You've hit the nail on the head. And realistically, now let me ask you this, we're running out of time. I pick the book up. I pick up Unstoppable. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Rigg, get that I did not have before I read that book?
I don't know. You tell me. Oh, you haven't read it yet.
I haven't read it yet. I just got it. Okay. But you know what? As a matter of fact, I'm going to read the book, but you have to send it to me. I'm going to read the book. I'm going to have me come back, and I'll tell you what I got out of the book.
It's really an interesting question because, you know what, I can't answer that for you because every single person that has read the book, and I've had more comments from men than women, which is really surprising because I originally wrote it thinking that, you know, I wanted to inspire women, you know, to not take this, not take that, get up, dust off, you know, keep going, whatever. And I got more compliments from men, and more, you know, corporate men and stuff like this. It was totally different. And these are the three letters that I got 99% of the time was, wow. Just wow. That's what I get.
Well, okay, we're about out of time.
Wow.
But the one thing that I do want to tell you, the one thing that I got about the 21 stab wounds you got, never will I go on an internet date.
What?
I won't go on a dating
service.
Say that
again?
I said I will never go on a dating service.
Why?
You got stabbed 21 times, right?
Yeah.
Never mind.
So.
It will get you in about 4 hours from now. All right, website we can find you at and buy the book.
Unstoppable.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show with us tonight.
It was fun. Okay, thank you. Have a great night.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely. And want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong. Yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah.
hit some of these days. I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Siobhan with us. She's the author of Breakthrough, The Five Living Principles to Defeat Stress, Look Great, and Find Total Well-Being. She's the mother of Vince Vaughn, is an East meets West lifestyle. That's what she lives. Fitness expert who's integrative and holistic. Health practice is changing the lives of women over 45 years old. She fell in love with the fitness in school as a dancer, cheerleader, and as an athlete, and later taught modern dance, jazz, tap, and ballet, and has been a way of life for her for a long, long time now. Shay, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much for having me on. I really am, you know, so happy to be here and have the opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Trained in ballet, Tai Chi, martial arts, Zumba, yoga, Pilates, and so much more. Shay, it really takes all of that to truly look at life in a completely different way. I believe in my heart of hearts today, somebody who gets, you know, when as they get older, they get sicker, and it starts to affect them, we have choice. We have choice in that matter, and it doesn't have to happen in the way that it happens to so many people.
Well, you're so right about that, and the beauty of having so many different formats, that was the inspiration basically to develop Shaynetics, which is my brand, because it does blend yoga, Pilates, Tai Chi, martial arts, gyrokinesis, dance, and so much more, which is really what you're seeing that's happening in the industry now. They even have spinning classes that are combined with Pilates classes because they really understand, number one, people don't have a lot of time to go out there and take separate classes, and they need to, you know, pack as much in as they possibly can in that hour and cross-train and really reap the benefits that really come from doing all of that.
And realistically, people can have all the quote-unquote cures in the world, and you can take all the supplements in the world, and you can do everything you want to do. But when it comes down to it, the only thing that's going to cure anything as it relates to health is your immune system. And when you are exercising and there is blood flow and your heart is starting to work and your immune system is working, all of those problems that most people have, they don't have to have them.
Well, that's right. They don't. But, you know, it's really funny because you see signs all over the, you know, about wellness. And I think that what people don't really understand is in this great big circle of wellness, there's a lot of things that are in there. And exercise is one component, you know, a can-do attitude about how we feel emotionally and the things that impact our life, our family, friends, all of that. And also, really, how we eat. So there's all of these things in there. And what we do with that is really what gets us to the state of well-being. And that's really what we're all trying to achieve in our life is a state of well-being. And that's one of the reasons that I really wrote the book, The Breakthrough. Because The Breakthrough is really about that there's, you know, there. It's not about having secrets. It's really about having answers. And it gives you the tools to power up your life with happiness and with well-being. You know, you want to live without fear and regret and really become that person that you've always wanted to be. So it really, you know, it's more about a winning philosophy for life than it is just really about exercise by itself.
Now, by the way, let me give us, and I say us, all of us, a great example of what exercise is going to do for you. I'm going to take you back about 20-some-odd years ago. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm in the middle of the interior and had horses up there. And there was one particular horse that I had that every time I go to saddle him, he'd go up, over, and backwards and down. And he put a fear in me, Shay, that I could not shake. So the trainer was about maybe a half mile away from the house. So what I would do is I would ride over there, and she would put me in what's called a round pen. The round pen is where you stand in the middle with a little bit of a whip, and you've got the rope, and you chase the horse around. She worked me so hard that I was out of breath, and she exercised me so strong chasing the horse that the fear went. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, exercise in and of itself is a great reducer or a reliever of stress. And it is the stress that causes the immune system to go. That's just a facet of it. But that's why I believe in exercise.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about reducing stress. And the breakthrough is really all about that, because it really gives you the tools. The thing that people don't realize is that we all need a guide. We need tools that are going to help us along our journey to reduce stress, to, you know, live a healthier life. And at the heart of the book and at the heart of Shaynetics is 5 living principles, and they are commitment, perseverance, self-control, integrity, and love. And I just want to point out that when you really think about commitment, you're really thinking about, you're not thinking about a New Year's resolution that you're going to, you know, fail at because you haven't given yourself permission to really succeed. You're really thinking about something that's really important to you. And it's important because it's something you want to achieve. You have a desire to do that. And perseverance is about, you know, taking one step at a time and building it, but, you know, really sticking to it and not giving yourself an excuse about why to get out of it when you know that you need to really stick it out and tough it out. And self-control is really about the balance in our life, about the integrity that we have, about, you know, finding, I always think about a crane standing on one leg and finding that balance in their life. And the pendulum doesn't always balance, but that's okay. We're always striving to get there. And then integrity really is about being honest with yourself and saying, hey, am I really giving 100% to what I'm doing so that I can get the best results that I'm looking for? And walking away from that really is love, because love is universal. And when you're making better choices, when you're setting better examples, I can tell you, I find it a whole lot easier to love myself when I feel that I'm giving back and when I'm doing the things that I know that I should be doing for others and for myself.
You said something very important, and someone to show you. Most of us go through life, and we have expertise in certain areas, but you can't be an expert in everything. And so many times, and if I have to say this 1,000 times a month, I will, you need someone to look over your shoulder and see what you don't see. And we need people holding us by the hand and say, do step 1, 2, 3, 4. And once you got it, it becomes a habit, and then you can move into it. And then just to switch areas here just for a moment, multivitamins and multibenefits. I think supplements are one of the greatest things that ever happened to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's definitely important. You know, if we ate right, and I'm definitely a believer in raw food and smoothies and adding some of those things just naturally into your, you know, your overall diet. But certainly supplementing it as we get older, we're not taking in and absorbing the food as much as we need to really help our immune system, as you said. And what I'm hoping to do as far as writing the book is concerned is really to touch as many hearts as I possibly can and to really be able to reach a broader, audience.
Okay, let's touch on something else, because I want to make sure we get a hold of a lot of the topics that you speak to. Meditation, extremely important. I've never been able to meditate more than about 20 seconds or so, but I'll work at it. But more important than that, in the meditation in and of itself, when you work out, when you're doing certain things, that in and of itself is a way to meditate. One of the best meditations that I ever had was I've been a bodybuilder probably 50 years now, and when
okay.
I work out, that's when I meditate. because I'm concentrated. And for most people, they feel like they have to sit there and, you know, float 2 feet off the ground and wear funny hats and you meditate. That's not what it's about.
No, I think that there's just, you know, most people hear the word meditation, and I think everybody has a different idea about what meditation is. I think they think it's about going into a room and lighting a candle and turning off the lights and kind of sitting there and trying to think about, you know, something. But it, really what it is, it's nothing more than directed focus. And directed focus just means, and that gives us a break from stress, because when you really take a break and you do meditate, then you really, you know, giving yourself, I don't believe that you can manage stress. In fact, I honestly feel that the harder that you try to manage stress, the more, you know, stressful I become. But I do know that you can give it a break. You can give it a break by going and taking, doing some exercise, reading a book, going to lunch with a friend, listening to music. There's a million ways that you can do that. And what happens is that I think that people get so overwhelmed in today's world that they can't even focus to the point where they direct that. So meditation, Shane Etics says, we have a saying that in Shane Etics, and I talk about it in the book, that meditation is focused, and what you're doing is that you're focusing on the moveset or the sequences that are put together, and the meditation part is just directing that focus to what you're doing and leaving everything else out the door. You know how I always say, you know, you can always pick up, you know, where you left off at, you know, before you came into class. It's kind of like dirty dishes. If you get up in the morning, they're still going to be there. But, you know, maybe at that point in time, you need to take a break from that. So meditation is so important in our life. It actually, when you really get to the point when you have directed focus, then clarity comes to you. And that's when you really can have that breakthrough that we're talking about. Because so many people walk around thinking about something as being a certain way, and then all of a sudden when they're in the moment, they're so much more aware of what's going on. They're listening to what's being said. And really, wow, bam, all of a sudden, you know, maybe you get that moment in time when all of a sudden clarity comes to you and you just, wow, it's the wow, I get it. And when we give ourselves that opportunity to be able to experience that, that brings clarity and balance to our life, we may not always like what we hear. And sometimes we have to adjust to that. But I can tell you, I've had, you know, I haven't grown up in a family where I didn't have my bumps and challenges, you know, on my own. But I can tell you that with those, it gave me the ability to be able to have that clarity and to be able to direct my thoughts and my love and my direction, if I can't do something else about it, towards something that's really going to be much more beneficial. Because you can't change everything and everybody. But what you can do is you can just make better choices about the things that you that are important to you, and about your family and about your friends and all the people that you love.
You can't change anybody, but you can change yourself. One of the things,
you know that
old adage about, you know, if you're in a plane and there's a problem and the oxygen drops and you get a baby in your arms, you put the oxygen on you because you can help the baby can't help you.
Exactly.
Yes, and
a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's not selfish. Moms feeling guilty about taking time to exercise, etc. If you don't have the fullness of yourself, how are you going to give it to someone else? So it's not selfish. It's actually doing the family a favor if you go out and exercise, meditate, and get yourself in condition.
Right. Well, it's about, you know, turning out. You want to get rid of the distractions that you have, trying to understand what is going on. Like I said, being aware, having awareness, and really realizing that the things that are really most important to us, you know, we can't take money with us, but we can take a lot of memories. And, getting through life, I think that, you know, by the time you're 45, you've lived a little bit, you're still multitasking a lot because there's so many different things to do in your life. I've got to share a story with you about multitasking. It's a story about a mother who is helping her son with his homework and on the phone texting the whole time. Kid grows up and they're having a conversation, and the mother says, what are you talking about? I was with you all the time helping you to do, you know, your homework. And the kid turns around and says, Mom, you were texting. So the perceptions there are very different in what somebody thinks that somebody gave and what somebody actually received.
Sure.
And so it's important that, you know, if you are going to be in that moment, you are going to do something, you're going to help somebody, that, once again, that meditation is about being in the moment, directing your focus on the things that are important for your life, because life is too short to take all of these regrets with you, and you don't have to do that.
Okay, there comes the Radio Susie's on the other side of the table. She's looking at me because she knows it's coming. This is the table example. The table, yes. The desk example. Okay, Shay, here we go. Are you sitting by a desk?
I am.
Touch the desk. Tell me when you touched it.
I did.
Okay, now, until you touched that desk, it didn't even exist, did it? It wasn't even there, was it?
No, because you just automatically, you know, you don't even think about that. It's just, you know, you're just sitting there and you're not even thinking about that. So when you do touch it, then it becomes a reality.
Yes, it comes into existence. And that, I think,
is
the essence of what you're talking about, being in the moment. That moment when your concentration, you allow it to be. You've touched it. You've touched yourself. Mm-hmm. You've touched your heart. You've touched something. But you've intentionally concentrated on a particular area. And now, all of a sudden, it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, the reality of it is that, you know, breakthroughs are straightforward, just like you're talking about, method for living, you know, a better life. You get, you know, tangible advice along with practical tools, and those practical tools, and we all need something, you know, in mentioning commitment, perseverance, self integrity, and love. The thing of it is that I want to share a story that really puts them all together. Normally, before I teach a class or do something, I always try to share something that brings in one of the principles. And one day, Scott was in my class, and I said, can anybody share something this week that happened? He raised his hand, and he said, you know, I got fired last week, and Friday was my last day. And he said, we were working on a project, and I really felt that it was an important project, at least it was to me. It wasn't finished, and I sat there that day, the last day of you know, on Friday, the last day I was going to be there. And he said, I really had to fight with myself about, do I finish the project? They probably don't even care if I go home early. You know, what do I do? And he said, I have to tell you, I really thought about the principles. And this is the example that I really want to share with you about what these principles and how powerful they can be when we actually bring them into our life. He said, I was committed to do the right thing. It took perseverance to get through it. I had to find and reach down inside of me for the self-control to work through it. I was, you know, I needed to show integrity that I wanted to do the right thing, even though, like I said, they probably didn't care whether I went home. And because I finished that, I didn't leave there feeling sad that I'd lost my job, but instead I walked away feeling good about myself because I know that I did the right thing.
Wonderful. By the way,
isn't that amazing?
Absolutely. Shay, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at?
The website is shaynetics.com, and that's SHEANETICS.com.
Wonderful. Shay Vaughn, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. I so appreciated it.
Take care. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Harry Dent Jr. with us. He's the co-author of The Great Crash Ahead, Strategies for a World Turned Upside Down. He's the founder of H.S. Dent, which publishes the H.S. Dent Forecast and oversees the H.S. Dent Financial Advisors Network. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Great Depression Ahead, and as well as The Great Boom Ahead. He stood virtually alone and accurately forecasting the unanticipated boom of the 1990s, a Harvard MBA, Fortune 100 consultant, in Bain & Company, a new venture investor, and an acclaimed speaker. And let us say, Harry, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. You know, Strategies for World Turned Upside Down. We are living in a world today, Harry, that we need a strategy. You cannot accidentally go out there and not worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. Because if you don't have a plan and if you don't have some kind of a forecast, whether you're in business or it's personal, you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, and to add to that, if you do the same things you did in the boom, you know, from 1983 to 2007, the same thing. And it will not work when we've got an environment with debt deleveraging, the biggest debt and credit bubble in history, the largest generation in history, shifting from spenders, borrowers, and home buyers to savers, and deflation in prices. So not only are we seeing a slowdown in our economy, it's going to last more than a few years, but it's going to be deflation in prices, something most of us have not seen in our entire lifetime.
Now, you talk about demographic trends. What are you talking about? Define that.
Well, you know, people do predictable things as they age. And I started up, you know, in the business consulting arena, studying consumer trends and the baby boom. And you know, for the first time in the 1970s and 80s, we have incredible statistics on everything people do. When they enter the workforce, you know, when they get married, have kids, buy their first home, second home, vacation homes, when they borrow the most money, save the most money, retire. Even potato chips, camping equipment, there's very few things we can't tell you. This is when people do this. So you have the largest generation in history, the baby boomers, you know, aging predictably. You know, we were able to predict 20 years ago that this boom would peak around 2008, give or take, and slow down. We were able to predict the disinflation of the 90s and the strongest spending surge of the baby boomers, just when everybody thought we were going into depression. We were able to predict the fall of Japan in the early 90s and beyond, in the late 80s, when people thought Japan was going to take over the world. So demographics let you see around the corner, I mean way around the corner, decades in advance, where most economists struggle to try to predict the next year or two based on political trends.
Well, sure. You're going to see cultural trends when you're talking demographic also. And one of the things that have been concerned with more than anything else, it's the culture. The mindset today is not what the mindset was 10 or 15 years ago. The amount of money that the administration, whoever is going to be in the administration, is giving to countries outside our borders here while we're having problems internally. While we are struggling, hundreds of billions of dollars, every time you turn around, somebody's getting a gift of something. We're not drilling here, you know, where we could be creating jobs. There are so many things that we could be doing here that we are not doing, and if for some reason, when we start to become who we are as far as an economically independent, somebody somewhere throws up a rule or a reg and it gets stopped.
Well, you know, I think one of the good things can happen. We see people say, well, you're bearish. Look, I've been the most bullish forecaster for 20 years up until recently. And, hey, the economy needs booms and busts, different seasons, spring, summer, fall, winter. We're going from fall to winter. And a lot of good things going to happen out of this very difficult crisis. I think we're going to eliminate tens of trillions of dollars of debt in the government and in the private sector. And the private sector has the most debt by far. we're going to simplify everything from our tax code to health care and a lot of things that have just been, you know, endless complications through all this lobbying. And like you say, any major change, there's no way we can continue to spend so much money helping the world, defending the world, doing all these sort of things when now we're slowing down at home. And then we've had two wars that are questionable and all this sort of stuff. So I think that there's a lot of good changes that are going to come. And sometimes it takes a crisis to force people to just get clear, go back to principles, and re-simplify, because everything's gotten too complex, everything's gotten too entrancing to change. I mean, you can't change anything anymore. Like you say, there's some lobbyist, there's some law, there's some group that's going to block it. When you have a crisis, people go into the barn, save the kid and the dog, come out a hero, and they don't get all complicated about it. So I think that's one of the good things, that the stimulus fails because baby boomers are not going to spend it, the economy's not going to turn around. And then we go into a crisis, unfortunately, so we're just warning people, get out of the way, you know, hunker down in your business, get into safer investments, let this deleveraging of debt and this next crash happen. It's already kind of starting. And just get out of the way and let it happen. And a lot of good things are going to come out of this, only because the government and people get forced to do some things we should have done a long time ago. And we have to restructure entitlements and Social Security and health care. They're not sustainable. We have to restructure our government spending and debt. It's simply not sustainable. I think all of this will happen in probably between 2013 and 16, after we see things kind of melt down like they did in 2008 or 2009.
Although, by the way, I couldn't debate anything you said, no matter which way I looked at it. I think you're spot on, and I'm on the same side of the table with you. I want to go back to demographics a moment and culture for a moment. If you watch any of the interviews of the kids that have been in New York demonstrating against Wall Street, quote unquote, the majority of the answers, why are you here? Why do you demonstrate? I don't know. Why are you here? Well, I'm here because, and so on and so, the fat cats, the rest of it. I really believe that we are in a culture right now that most people have no idea how to define money, how to define where we are, what to do about it. And when you want to take money away from the people who create the dollars to expand and create jobs and so on and so forth, that there's something wrong with that picture. Yes, there's the Madoffs and a few people who have done some bad things. Not everybody who has money is a bad person. And there is today a class separation that I have never seen before. One of the things that we have to do, Harry, is get back together. I don't care if it's socially, you know, economically, politically, because if we don't do that, we're going to implode, and it doesn't matter what kind of forecast there is for finances. We may not even own this country in 10 years if we are not careful and do what you were talking about doing.
Yeah, you know, it really is interesting, because I've never seen things this polarized either, not in the 70s, and that was a crisis, an inflation crisis, a different type of crisis. The 30s was the worst crisis we ever went through, but we didn't have this much. But there was kind of a bit of a, you know, railing against the rich kind of thing and that sort of thing. But it really is true. I mean, I started my own business. I consulted entrepreneurs. That's why I learned most of the stuff I learned about economics, not from economic school and stuff like that. And it literally is true that like 1% of people, it is kind of like the Steve Jobs, that challenge society, do something very different or persistent. And you know, Henry Ford, those type of people, and a lot of smaller entrepreneurs that actually make the major changes that then reverberate throughout society for decades. And those people do tend to make the most wealth. 1% of the people control anywhere between 30 and 50% of the wealth over time, but it's because they take huge risk, innovate, go against the grain, and frankly, a lot of them are tortured and then fail for decades. It's not an easy thing to do, and people don't appreciate that most of the benefits, the progress we make, does come from this 1% of what I call entrepreneurial kind of business people and social innovators and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think, you know, probably the rich have probably been taxed a little too little for something, But it's a mistake to go and just totally attack these people and say, well, now, you know, they caused all the problems. Yes, people went nuts. I mean, frankly, it was more in the financial system. Entrepreneurs tried a lot of things. A lot of them failed. And all the progress we see in the coming decades will come from, you know, the last decade where a lot of businesses tried a lot of new things. And it's high risk, but it's what creates the best for society.
Sure. And here we go back and track it. I probably have told the story 5,000 times on the air over the years, but if you take a real close look at it, you had your mom and pop organizations who were doing fine. You walked in, they patted you on the back. They know who your mom, your dad was, and your dog. And then they went out of business. The corporations, the major businesses, ran them out of businesses because the mom and pops could not compete with the corporations. Then the corporations started getting into global businesses. Now it was universal, and they were in competition with China and India and so on and so forth. They couldn't compete, so they let a lot of people go. They outsourced. Then came the entrepreneur, the person that sits down at their computer, and now they're in business for themselves. Mom and pop is back. But the problem, the mom and pop is back, is the entrepreneur that's trying to make as much money as they possibly can, and they're getting chastised for it. So it's a very interesting catch-22 that we have out there. They say, go out and make everything you can make. This is the country you can make it in. But if you make it, we're going to slap you on the wrist.
Well, again, you know, there's a lot of pros and cons here. But, I mean, I think we need a lot more clarity. And a lot of times just when I give talks, people say, well, gosh, you're so clear. And I say, well, it's because I'm looking at reality. I'm not hoping for a turnaround here, hoping the stimulus will work. We were more bullish than most people in the boom, and people kept saying, how can you be that bullish? I'm like, well, we're looking at baby boomers, and there's a lot of them. They're going to spend money. They're big innovators. And now we're saying, look, the government's just wasting money, throwing trillions of dollars to try to get aging people to spend money. You've got to help revamp the economy. You've got to write down these excessive debts that the banking system created against real estate that's now falling, and take the burden back off people. Take regulations off people. Take the excess debt, and you will free up people to innovate and spend again. But you can't stop people from aging and saving, because that's what aging people do. They don't buy a bigger house. So, you know, it's just that's what I think the best innovators and entrepreneurs do. They look at reality and they see something that doesn't match up. They just go for it, and then they persist with it until it comes through. It takes that sort of thing, because most people, frankly, are not in reality about anything, the economy, politics, our future, good or bad. People just aren't in reality. They're just basically hopeful.
And herein, Harry, lies the problem. The problem is we've got hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, sitting in the coffers for a lot of these major businesses. They're not going to let the money go because they can't forecast and know if they expand here what it's going to cost them, what their health insurance is going to cost. The list goes on and on and on. And so we've got a lot of money that they won't spend because of that, the unsureness. You're also sitting in a situation whereby we're yelling and screaming about the 8 to 10% unemployment. What about the 90% that are employed out there? Obviously, we're not guaranteed that anybody will, the job they have today, they will have in a week, a month, 2 months from now. But there is a lot of money out there that everybody's holding on to because they don't know what's going to happen if they spend it.
Yeah, I think it's also true, though. Businesses, they're not totally stupid. They look at consumers, and they're seeing that consumers are cautious and aren't spending in a lot of areas, and certainly not in housing. What we found, like in the Great Depression, everybody says, well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt turned it around. No, he came in after the banking system had totally meltdown. The debt had been totally restructured down much lower. In other words, the burden had already been lifted from the economy, so things were freed up to go again. We cannot move forward, businesses, consumers, anybody, until the government deals with this $42 trillion in private debt that was created. And now on top of that, $14 to $15 trillion in government debt. Until we get this debt down to manageable levels, everybody's got a big question mark about the future, businesses and consumers. And especially if consumers are concerned and are not ready to move forward, businesses won't. So I think that the problem is the government has not come in here and just tackle this problem and say, look, we got a debt problem. I call it Chapter 11. And a business got in this situation, our government, our economy's in, you just restructure the debt with creditors. You know, people would take their losses. You'd clear the decks and you'd move on, and you'd be able to move on without $42 trillion on your back and without decades of Social Security and health care that there's no way we're going to pay. The young people today got to know that they don't have a chance if baby boomers are going to, you know, insist on collecting all these endless health care and Social Security entitlements that were promised in a boom that looked like it would never end. Now the boom's ended, and there's no way they're going to be able to get this without bankrupting young families. So we got to deal with the debt, got to deal with entitlements. Then I think businesses and consumers would feel better about moving forward and investing in the future again.
By the way, I think Perry was right about one thing, that the Social Security was nothing more than a Ponzi scheme. When you truly look at it, the money that came from Social Security came from people who were working 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I think the Clinton administration, that would, you know, everything was fine. He got us out of, you know, he got the economy in a good position, but at the same time, took everything out of the security lockbox, threw it into the general fund, and paid bills. Money had to come from somewhere.
Right, and it has always been more that, you know, the present young generation pays for the retiring old generation. When you always had a lot more younger people coming along, like the baby boomers, that's okay. But for the first time, the echo boom generation is yeah. going to be a bit smaller than the baby boom generation, and you can't just keep running this thing about more and more benefits from less and less workers. So there's no question, Social Security is nowhere near as big a problem as health care. Health care is 4 to 5 times the problem, but you can't have younger people, especially when there's fewer of them in the future relative, supporting more and more old people who expect to be taken care of for 20 to 30 years after retirement. Our retirement age should start at a minimum at age 72 with today's yeah. life expectancies. When they started Social Security, the life expectancy was more like 65, so it wasn't such a boondoggle.
Sure, I have no question about it. We're starting to run out of time now. So let me ask you this. Is there a question that I did not ask you, Harry, that I should have asked you, that would have brought information up that we, the audience, needs to hear? You're dealing with our lives here.
Yeah, well, I think the key thing is investors need to realize everything. Remember 2008, 2009, when the financial system melted down. We see that happening again in the next year or two. Everything went down. This is unusual. Real estate went down. Commodities, gold, silver, oil really went down. Stocks, U.S., emerging countries even that didn't have a recession, Europe. So there was nowhere to hide. When a bubble like this burst and a debt bubble deleverages, which only happens once in a lifetime, like the 1930s, you got to get out of the way. You got to get in safe investments. If you're an aggressive investor, you got to bet. You can bet on things going down, but don't think I can sit in a diversified portfolio and be okay, because people got clobbered in 2008-9. The same for businesses. Hunker down, cut your costs. If you're going to sell your business, sell it now. If you're going to stay with it, cut your costs. Only spend money on things that create short-term cost-cutting or revenues. Just survive this thing. If you survive, your competitors will be in trouble, and you will grow long-term. So it's a whole different environment from the last 3 decades. You've got to think differently. You've got to think deflation, not inflation, which means gold and silver don't work in deflation. And you've got to think, protect my capital. Because forget about whether you earn 1 or 2 or 3 or 4% of your portfolio. You've got to protect your capital so you don't lose it, and you still have money to buy things when we see the greatest sale in financial assets in history. Ask Joseph Kennedy. He sold his stocks in 29, rebought at the bottom at 20 cents on the dollar, everything.
Yeah, so we're going to have to change that old saying, and we'll get T-shirts out that says CYC, save your capital.
Right.
Yeah, that'll hit you about 4 o'clock. Morning. Harry, well, do you have a website that we can find you at?
Yes, hsdent.com. And the book just came out, The Great Crash Ahead. You can get that at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And, yeah, we got a lot of free information on the website, and you can get a free copy of our newsletter.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You're going to miss my hugging you. Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby,
when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you now, some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark, the zigzag principle, the goal-setting strategy that will revolutionize your business and your life. Rich Christensen with us. He is the co-founder of 32 businesses, each with less than $10,000. And, of course, 11 were complete failures, but 11 have become multimillion dollar companies. He describes himself as a perfectly good technology executive turned entrepreneur from his time at Mitsubishi Electric, About.com, and Novell. And again, he's the author of The Zigzag Principle and the co-author of The Bootstrap Business, a Step-by-Step Business Survival Guide, both of which provide an inside look into the action formula for business success. And let us say, Rich, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Rich, when it really comes down to it, I think the operative words here are the step-by-step survival guides, whether it be the zigzag principle, business survival. In today's economy, it is so confusing and so uncertain that if you don't have a strategy, you're going to be in major trouble.
You know, I really agree with you, and I think so frequently we make it far more complicated than we have to. You know, the zigzag principle, the fundamental tenet is that we should set this crazy big hairy goal out there and then race towards that goal, and then we wonder why 9 out of 10 small businesses fail. The reality is if we systematically and pragmatically put footholds in place where we charge to definable, you know, more simple objectives, we're just, our probability of success just goes up exponentially.
Yeah, one of the things that you've got on the face of the book, which I think really makes a lot of sense, the road to success is never a straight line. It is not going to happen that way, and you better be able to zig when the road zags and be able to move through.
You know, I the question I love to ask you, ask everyone, is this, Michael, did you drive directly to work today? When I ask that question, everyone always raises their hand, and I say, no, you didn't. If you would have, you would have hit your neighbor's dog, you would have ran into the lake, you would have ran the stop sign, and probably wouldn't have made it 100 yards. The reality is our entire life is filled with avoiding crazy big hairy obstacles. You know, even the spacecrafts that were going to the moon, were only on target like 2 or 3% of the time. Rivers don't flow in straight lines. Mountains have contours. And it only makes sense that in our lives we have to detour around the crazy big hairy obstacles.
Now, by the way, that's really the operating word is detour. And I mean, even years ago, Rich, if somebody got into a business, even if they had the right amount of operating capital, they had their 6 months to a year operating capital, they knew exactly where they were going, they had their target market, etc. It was not, and it has never been, a straight line. And I think that in and of itself will cause a tremendous amount of businesses that may have had that opportunity to do a really good job out there fail.
I totally agree. As a matter of fact, the biggest failures that I've had in my life came when I raced directly towards my goal, and I got there. But the target had moved by the time that I got there. On the other hand, the biggest successes that I've had came when I actually set the target out there. I still very strongly promote and encourage to set the crazy big hairy goal out there, but then turn and look for the quickest path to profitability. Sometimes even doing what I call dancing your tutu. You know, in the early stages of business, I won't dance naked, mind you, but I will put on a tutu and go and dance in the freeway if that's what it takes to get to profitability. You see, once you're at profitability, then you have oxygen in your tank and you're breathing and you're able to progress to the next step. So in my philosophy of zigzagging, there's three pragmatic steps that I take, and the first is definitively
set the goal and then instantly charge to a profitable event rather than just chase off into the wild dark.
No, absolutely. I think another way to say that is if you were body surfing down a river and you were going into a big stone that was sitting there in the middle of the river, if you resist that stone, you're going to become part of that stone. You're going to crash. But if you quote unquote go with the flow, you go with the current, you go around the stone. And I think that's the zigzag principle. Because if you resist and you charge straight forward, you're going to insert yourself into the stone, and it's all going to stop.
Now you've given me a great new analogy to use, but indeed, that's exactly correct. I mean, in life we do. We avoid big, hard obstacles, and in life it makes sense that we do it also. You know, it's also so exhilarating to people to give them permission to actually get to a profitable event, even if it's not going directly to their long-term goal. The key thing is to get guardrails or boundaries on these zigs and these zags so we don't end up in the weeds.
You know, I've got your press release in front of me, and I think I happen to open up to a page that I think it really says it all. And it says whether you're a parent or an entrepreneur, a factory worker, a middle manager, the zigzag principle will provide you with a framework and a formula that will empower you to make changes in your world that you had never felt were possible before. Joe Grenny said that, New York Times bestselling co-author of Influencer, The Power to Change Anything. But the more important is that the principle is the principle is the principle, and it does not have to be in business. If you follow the same kind of principle, it's going to work for you as an individual.
I absolutely. Whether it's parenting. As a matter of fact, I really think that we apply zigzag principle, you know, in our family as much as we do even in business. One of the joyful events that's taken place is as part of proving the principles in zigzag. I not only had my general manager take and create a business that's now, it'll probably do $4 or $5 million this year following the principles, but I also assembled a team of teenagers. They're rock starring it. It's amazing what they've done following these principles. And I also assembled a team of stay-at-home moms. The exact same result. They've been able to have tremendous success following these tactical steps. Would you mind, Michael, if I just shared quickly with you what the three zigs and zags are?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, brilliant. So the first thing you do is you obviously set your big target and your goal. And then the first thing you do is you divert. You chase quickly to cash and to get to profitability. Once you've hit profitability, then you turn, you just like a skier, you invert, go the other zag, and that's adding resources and processes. And then the third zag is to add a scale element. And so literally as I'm building businesses or setting goals, I sequence the next three events in front of me in that order. Just like a skier skiing down the mountain, they don't look down the mountain, point their tips, and just race down the hill and break their neck. The proper thing to do is look in front of you and allocate most of your resource to that first turn, knowing that you're going to have a couple other turns. Then when you hit that first turn, then you put your attention on where that second turn is, and you may change course even a little bit. And I always sequence three in advance.
Okay, so realistically, we are looking at a strategy to use, and it's the sequence of three. That's going to be the strategy. But that's really where the key is, and you can do it with anything that you're going to do in life. So really we're talking about look ahead of yourself in the future. You can't forecast the future, but if you have plan A, plan B, plan C, and if you can move with it, then all of a sudden you got what you just said, possibility.
Yes, that's very accurate. There's a couple other very liberating things that this allows us to do. The first is what I call failing efficiently. I still fail. True, I founded 32 businesses now. I mean, I'm not that old. I'm old, but not that old. How do you start 32 businesses? The reality is what I've learned to do is just fail very efficiently. Most people will start a business, and they'll chase that business 10 years, and it's a stupid business. They had no right doing it in the first place. They wake up 10 years later and say, oh, that was a stupid business. Using this model, what I do is I very carefully put a guardrail around those zigs and zags, and I say, I'll give myself 3 months. I'll chase towards that target. I'll give this amount of cash. I'll use this much of my relationship capital. Then I race like crazy to that goal, and if I don't hit it, I dust myself off. I say, ow, that really hurt. Go back to start and call it a failure. I think allowing yourself to fail and learning how to fail efficiently in entrepreneurship and in life is as important as actually succeeding.
Now, I give it to you this way. You co-founded 32 businesses. Of those 32 businesses, 11 were complete failures. And if it wasn't for those 11, the other 11 would have never become multimillion-dollar companies. You don't learn unless you fall down. You can go to all the schools in the world and you can get academic the information. But it's when you're out there and you get knocked down, Rich, and you stand back up again, that's when the wisdom comes. And there is a difference between the information and the wisdom to use it. And all of your failures, somebody could take advantage of anticipating the problems that you have and not have them if they pick up the book. They get to learn by what you didn't do to make something successful.
That's a great way to put it. Indeed, I am as proud of my failures as I am the successes. I think one of the other really empowering aspects of the zigzag principle is that it gives people the courage to actually, hey, go give a whack at it. You don't have to risk everything. You don't have to run down to Vegas. You don't have to put everything in on black and then just race your life at it and hope it works out okay. I'm a real strong believer in not risking everything, as you can see, starting with $5,000 to $10,000. If $5,000 to $10,000 is too much, that's okay. Do it with 500, or do it with 50, or do it with 5. I really don't care. The only difference is you're going to have to take a whole bunch more zigs and zags to get to your end destination. The key thing is to get people uncrippled and get them moving and get them doing something to take control of this financial mess we have in our country right now.
I was going to say, you said that before I was going to get to it. Is there any way that you can send the book to Congress?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, I wish that I could. As a matter of fact, and I hope I'm not too passionate on this subject and too vocal, but you know what? I got news for you. Our job stimulus package is not going to solve our problem. We have to add value. We have to add value, and that problem is going to rest on the back of business owners and entrepreneurs. And the bank bailout's not going to solve the problem either. It's going to require us simply creating value, and at that point we'll create jobs and get ourselves out of this mess.
No, and by the way, when it really comes down to it, we have forgotten that term personal responsibility. We are a country who became what we were and why we were because we had that. There's a land of, you have freedom of opportunity. There's a lot of freedoms that they said we had that we really don't have. But we do have the freedom of opportunity, and that still stays. And as long as you have that, it gives you the responsibility to go make this place as great as you can. People have come here, used to come here for years, and the reason they would come here because they could make something of themselves here. There was a particular culture. You could do whatever you wanted to do. Now you can't do it that much anymore, and I think business is held back. Business is hamstrung because of it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It concerns me the level of entitlement that oftentimes has occurred, not only in our country, but also through the world. The reality is if we simply get out and we do something significant, we add value, then we're going to make money. First chapter in the book, I actually highlight what I call the value equation. This was from my dear friend Garrett B. Gunderson, the New York Times bestselling author of Killing Sacred Cows, but I reconstituted his material. And it's simply this. Most people think it takes a bunch of money to make money. It doesn't. What it takes is intellectual capital, or being smart. You get smart at something, and then you serve someone, which is relationship capital. So intellectual capital plus relationship capital, powerful people. If you do it the equal sign in the form of a business, it always yields money. Most people get that all backwards, thinking that it takes money to make money. That's the least important part of the equation.
No question about it. Rich, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can reach you at, find you at, and buy the book?
I sure do. The website is zigzagprinciple.com. You're going to love it. It has on it a whole bunch of free tools. Of course, a newsletter where I do smart interviews with some of the top entrepreneurs and my peers and colleagues. Encourage you to do that. Of course, the book is also for sale. I was delighted that I got to number 2 position on the day it launched in Amazon. We're expecting it to hit New York Times bestselling list this next week, and so invite everyone to come participate. And we just comment that this book's the best that I have, and the reason that I wrote it is to help us to reclaim reclaim our jobs and to have an impact here again in America. And indeed, this formula works. Since using this formula, I've now went 4 for 5. I used to go 1 for 3. 4 out of 5 of my businesses have now succeeded using this formula.
Wonderful. Hey, Rich Christensen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I certainly appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Aging Issues Authority and inspirational speaker Carolyn Brent, MBA, is the author of Why Wait? The Baby Boomer's Guide to Preparing Emotionally, Financially, and Legally for a Parent's Death. The critical guide helps family caregivers and aging parents have crucial conversations in preparation for the end-of-life issues that they may face so that instead of being torn apart, they can come together as a strong family. And let us say, Carolyn, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm very honored to be here this evening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the issue in and of itself is an issue that most people do not want to face. I mean, it's inevitable, and it's not that easy to take a look at, and especially when you're dealing with baby boomers. The boomers at this stage of the game, in the next 5-6 years, they're going to start to retire, meaning that they're at that 60-ish kind of age, which means parents are 80 and 90 years old, and there's got
to be
some prep time. Carolyn, let me ask you this. What was it that triggered you? What caused you to look at this issue and delve into it the way you have?
Well, you know what, Michael, that's an excellent question, and the way I could answer it is that I started caring for my dad back in 1997, and I'm one of 8 children. However, I never had any kids of my own. So my adult siblings said, well, Carolyn, you could take care of Dad because you have the time, you have the resources, so you can do a really good job. And 12 years of being a professional in the pharmaceutical industry, taking care of my dad, spending money out of my own pocket for him to stay in private assisted living, towards the end of my father's life, when they thought Dad was dying, then all of my family members decided it's time for them to take over, push me aside. And the way in which they accomplished that, I had abuse charges filed against me in three jurisdictions. My sibling member would go to one court, file abuse charges, and then get in front of the judge and say, oh, I dropped the charges. Then she would go to another jurisdiction. Oh, Your Honor, I dropped the charges. She did that three times. And what I decided to do, I said, I'm not going to fight my family. This is absolutely ridiculous. I'm going to go and to Congress and really show that there is a horrible problem within our own judicial system, and we need to be able to safeguard our seniors and safeguard the caregiver from, we call it the scary side of a power of attorney. Because when someone falsifies any documentation, then they automatically becomes temporary power of attorney, and that's happening on a daily basis. So that's
Go ahead. I thought you paused there for a minute. Go ahead, finish.
Yeah, I was going to say that is why I'm so passionate about this change, and I have been working with the U.S. Congress for the past 4 years, and I will not stop until there are some laws in place to for safeguarding purposes.
Now, when you talk about safeguarding, and I think it's critically important, and most people have no idea what to do. Everybody doesn't have a legal bent to their side and have no idea how to protect. You know, my recommendation, and I am not a clinician, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not a financial consultant, that said, but, you know, a living trust in most cases to get things started, at least you've got someone with a working power of attorney, you've got someone running the trust, and also if something happens to that parent, the estate, they don't die intestate, they die, and it doesn't go to the courts, and it doesn't have to go through probate that can cost an arm and a leg and take a percentage of whatever is left over. So there are people that need to prepare in front, but they need some kind of a tool to do this preparation to make sure that their loved ones are taken care of after they die, or something happens that's set up ahead of time for those who do die.
Absolutely. And what I'm actually really, I'm going around the country and I'm actually saying this to everyone. You cannot start too soon. I believe that a person should start sharing end-of-life issues with their kids as young as 12 years old so that children will not grow up like we are, adults afraid of the conversation death. Here in America, we are the only country that look at death as an option, because we will say, if something happens to me, or if I die, this is what I want. However, nothing is put in writing, and it's more than knowing a person's wishes, and it's also very, very important for a person to know that they should have whatever wishes their parents or themselves, the baby boomers, because baby boomers are pretty up there in age too, to put everything in writing. And I think a lot of times, most often, people will not do it because they'll think, you know what, it's going to be too expensive. It's going to cost me way too much money. I'll put it off. And there's LegalZoom.com where you could actually start putting things together as low as maybe $20. And people don't realize they could actually facilitate their own. However, the more estate a person has, the wealthier they are, the assets, then it's really a good idea to have an attorney that specializes. Now, not just any attorney, but one that specializes in trust and also wills. And the only time a trust is actually to someone's advantage is when they are dead. That's what I really want to get straight, because a person thinks, oh, if I have a trust, then my life is going to be like perfect while I'm alive. A trust is only good when you're dead, because then nobody can contest that. However, a person really needs to have a will and a trust, and appoint a trustee, appoint a fiduciary, or a dual, it's called a dual medical of attorney, they could have someone that could be over the medical or someone that could be over the finances. They could do that very, very easily. And it's not really hard. People shouldn't be afraid of it. I think the reason why families are torn apart is because things are not in place properly.
I remember once, it must have been 20, 30 years ago, and I will never forget this, and it's an example of what you're talking about. I was married at the time, and her brother was killed in a motorcycle accident. He was in his early 30s at the time. And it was a situation whereby I remember it to this day, having to walk in there and tell the parents what happened, having to go through the process of getting a coffin and so on and so forth. I would never want to go through that again. And, you know, if I have to, I have to. But the point here is, who knew to prepare? Not that it makes right. death any easier, but you had two people who had no idea of what to do. They were totally lost. Here, all of a sudden, their son is taken away from them. Where do you go from there?
Absolutely. That's yeah. why it's so imperative for people to talk early, talk often, talk soon, have everything in writing, and then they don't have to fuss with that anymore. And then once something happens that's sudden and unexpected, because, you know, the key thing is that we all think we're going to live, you know, to a nice, ripe old age, and that's nowadays people are living longer, but not necessarily in the best of health. So if they could put their things in writing and have those crucial conversations, and I really do believe it's really the parents' responsibility while they're healthy and in their right mind, rightful mind, meaning that they don't have dementia or anything going on, to sit the family down. Most parents, they know their kids. They'll know that if someone is brilliant with money and they could be a really good fiduciary, or maybe somebody's very good with medical, but select your fiduciaries based on solid qualifications, and also love has to be thrown in there, because if the parents are estranged from their kids, then that's something that they want to be able to put in writing, that I don't want John Doe to be a part of, you know, if I die, to contest it. They could put that in writing as well. So I believe when a person really puts everything in writing and plan, just like we plan for birth, we plan for weddings, we plan for education and what, just everything. But when was the last time the family got together and planned for end of life? Have we ever?
No. And something else that I remember way back when, I found out about it afterwards. Now, not all states do this. I think California does. You can go to one of the funeral homes and prepay a burial. So it's all set up. Everything's chosen ahead of time. So, if, you know, God forbid, when it does happen, at least you have the process to go through, the people to call, and everything set up ahead of time. Now, not many. Some of the other states don't have that. And there are some states where the reason the funeral homes won't is the way the state has set it up is whereby if you pay for it, it goes into trust until somebody dies and the funeral home can't get a hold of the money until. But that would, it would be a good idea if you're going to prepare, if you're in a state that allows that.
Right, absolutely. And also, on one of my radio shows, I talked about some family members said, well, you know, we don't have any money. What can we do if this happens? Now, cremation can be an option. And the reason why I say that, if a family member, if they want to donate their organs to science, to the enrichment and betterment of individuals in the future for science, then the institutions will actually cremate the body, send the body back, and in a crane, and the person can actually have a very free, everything's free. So it just depends on what the person wants, but the average funeral here in the U.S. starts at $6,000, and then sure. It just increasingly goes up.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm not going to die.
Okay. Okay, that's great. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Now, by the way, one of the things I think is critically important, Carolyn, about the book, and it's what everybody needs. You symbolically, you hold their hand. It's a step-by-step process, spares caregivers and the family all the stress and conflict when everybody's grieving and there's that problem right there. And also, I think it's very important about the opportunity to mend fences before it even happens. I will never forget in that one given situation I was talking about, the guilt that goes on. You know, you got a funeral director, and he says, here's his casket for $10,000, here's one for $200. Which one are you going to pick? Well, I've got to pick the $10,000 one because I'm guilty.
But if, absolutely.
But if you did it ahead of time,
absolutely,
and you talked about it, you wouldn't have to do that. There wouldn't be any guilt because it would be of the option of the choice of that person who was going to pass away.
Absolutely. That's key. It's so much easier when people plan ahead, period. So I think that when people plan ahead, the families can come together as one, talk about the crucial conversations that nobody wants to talk about, but then they could learn to really love each other and appreciate each other more, because we do know we all have an end of life, but we just don't know when it's coming.
Yeah, but here's the deal. We're starting to run out of time now. In 150 years from now, you and I have a date to do another show so I can prove I was right.
Okay.
Carolyn, let me ask you this. Where's the website we can find you at and get the book?
Very easy. It's called caregiverstory.com. It's
okay,
where the book is at.
No, Caregiver Story.
It's called caregiverstory.com.
Okay, now beside the book, where can people get involved with you? I mean, are there programs that you have? Are there classes that you do? Is there coaching that you do? What else can we...
Absolutely. On caregiverstory.com, that is a total resource center for anyone that needs medical, legal, or any type of resources. I also offer seminars on the caregiverstory.com. There's videos on there. It's everything that a person thinks that they want is there. And one thing about it, I offer all of the resources. It costs absolutely nothing for a person to go grab whatever resources they need and keep going. And I put that together based on my 12 years of caring for my dad and everything that I needed to know that I couldn't find out there. And I've decided, let me put this online and a person could just go and peruse my website. Whatever they need, they could go get. So it's right there for them. But getting in contact with me, the book, anything that they want to know about caregiverstory.com, me, or the book is right there at one fingertip.
Wonderful. Hey, Carolyn, Brent, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, and I do hope to see you in 150 years.
You got a deal. We'll be here.
Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I got a funny feeling. Okay.